From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Thanks to high-powered instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope, astronomers are learning so much about our universe, the age of the universe, how black holes and quasars interact, how stars evolve. But frankly, there's more material to comb through than there are researchers, and that's where you come in. Scientists from around the world are fishing around for stargazers. Students, retirees, workers on their lunch breaks, anyone who can help them pore over images of Andromeda, the spiral galaxy closest to the Milky Way. Today on the program, we're talking about the Andromeda Project and the mysteries that astronomers are hoping to discover with your help. Plus, for those behind on their house payments, help is on the way. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Astronomers are urging everyone to get to know your neighbor, your galactic neighbor, that is. Andromeda is the closest spiral galaxy to the Milky Way, and scientists are looking for volunteers to help study its star clusters through detailed images captured by the Hubble telescope. Today on the program, we're learning more about the Andromeda Project and how crowdsourcing can help further research into the nature of the universe. It sounds very lofty. Dr. Anil Seth is with us. He's an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah. His research focuses on nuclear star dusters. We're going to find out what those are in a bit, and black holes. And he's also helping to launch this effort to study the Andromeda galaxy called the Andromeda Project. Dr. Seth, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
And Dr. Seth will discuss the Andromeda Project during Science Night Live. That's happening tonight, December 5th at 5:30 at Keys on Main. We'll give you more details on that, along with the website on with more information later on in the program. And following this discussion, we'll hear about help for those facing foreclosure and just what the options are out there. But first, spreading the love for astronomy. How do you stargaze, and why do you stargaze? And if you don't, but you want to start, what's holding you back? Join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Seth, your online bio says you're learning to be an amateur astronomer, not just a professional one. What do you mean by that?
Well, this semester I had the pleasure of teaching an observational astronomy class, and it involved learning to use small telescopes. And I've always used big telescopes for my research, you know, things that have mirrors maybe 8 meters across and that are the size of the room. But, you know, now what I've done this semester is learn how to use all these small telescopes that everyone uses, all the amateur astronomers use. And so that's been a real fun adventure.
What have you learned?
Well, I've learned to find objects with my own on my own without a telescope operator sitting there trying to find them for me when I tell them the coordinates. I've also really enjoyed sharing that with all my students.
We're going to get into this in much more detail throughout our conversation, but briefly, what is the Andromeda Project that you're launching?
Yeah, this is a project that we're seeking volunteers to identify groups of stars in the Andromeda Galaxy. And the Andromeda Project, the images that we're using on the website come from the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope is one of our premier, you know, astronomical facilities, and it's spending about 2 months of its time over the past few years imaging the Andromeda Galaxy. And there's a really huge number of images that have come down. You know, you spend 2 months looking at something, you're going to get a lot of images. And we're not able to write computer programs to effectively identify these star clusters. So we're hoping to involve other people and get volunteers to help us help us identify all these star clusters.
Why focus on Andromeda? I mean, why not study something closer, like the Milky Way?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in the Milky Way, we live inside the Milky Way. And that means that it's really hard for us to know how far away things are from us in the Milky Way. So if we see a star and it's really bright, we don't know if it's really bright because it's really close to us or because it's really, really, really intrinsically bright and very, very far away. And measuring distances is very difficult. And the other thing is that we're sitting in the middle of this debris disk, this gas and dust that's sitting in the Milky Way, and we can't even see the center of our own Milky Way. It's just covered up by a dust cloud. So with our eyes, you know, when you look out in the, towards the constellation of Sagittarius, which is kind of to the south, you can see a big dust lane going right through where we know now the center of our galaxy is.
So what do we know about Andromeda already? I mean, it seems kind of funny that we are learning more about our universe by looking at something that's so far away. What do we already know about this spiral galaxy, and what exactly does a spiral galaxy mean?
I'll take the what is a spiral galaxy first off. The spiral galaxy is a flattened, like frisbee-shaped group of stars, and they're all moving around a common center of the galaxy. And they typically, we call them spiral galaxies because they typically have these little arms of bright forming stars. And if you've seen a picture of galaxies, this is probably pretty familiar to you. They have these typically very blue-looking arms of bright stars.
But I mean, how is it distinguished from a regular old galaxy?
So it is kind of a regular old galaxy.
It's just the shape.
There's two main types of galaxies. There's what are called elliptical galaxies, which are more round objects. They're maybe just like a basketball shape. And then there's spiral galaxies, which are flattened. And these spiral galaxies are really very typical galaxies. Our Milky Way is not an unusual galaxy, and Andromeda is very similar. And the Andromeda galaxy is really it's our closest big neighbor, and it's for a long time it's had a role to play in understanding the size and shape of our universe. For instance, back in the 20s, Edwin Hubble used it to figure out the distance. He found variable stars, and from those variable stars, he was able to determine the distance. And he figured out that was way beyond the distance of stars in our own Milky Way. And so from that, you know, all of a sudden our universe expanded in its size just from that measurement. And so for a long time, it's played this role, and now we're using it to try kind of understanding as a template for understanding spiral galaxies in general.
I understand that it's the furthest object that you can see with the naked eye. It's pretty big. Where in the night sky is it?
It's actually, if you were to go out this evening around, 7 or 8 o'clock, it would be in the kind of northeast, to the northeast. So, look up over the hills. And you can't actually see it with your naked eye from Salt Lake City very well, because there's so many bright lights here. But if you go anywhere outside of the city, you can definitely see it. I took my students down to Frisco Peak, which is an observatory that we have down in southern Utah earlier this year, and you could see Andromeda spectacularly from there. You could actually tell that it was a extended disk of stars.
So. We're speaking with Dr. Anil Seth. He is an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah, and he is one of the partners in something called the Andromeda Project. He is going to be speaking about what exactly this is during Science Night Live tonight, Wednesday, December 5th at 5:30 p.m. at Keys on Main, 242 South Main Street here in Salt Lake City. Also, you can find out a lot more about being a citizen scientist in the Andromeda Project effort at andromedaproject.org. We've got links on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us, if you're interested in learning more about Andromeda, if you want to find out more about the discoveries that astronomers are making from the images captured by the Hubble telescope, you can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Seth, I read somewhere that the earliest documented reference to Andromeda was in the 10th century. So we've known about this spiral galaxy for quite some time. You mentioned the discoveries from Hubble observing this in the 1920s. Can you give us some other highlights of the observational history of Andromeda?
Yeah, it was actually the first galaxy that we found a supernova in, which are explosions of really massive stars. And that happened actually in the 19th century. Someone observed a supernova going off in that galaxy. They didn't know what it was at the time, but we now know what it was. And in recent years, some of the most interesting discoveries of Andromeda have been of the outer parts of the Andromeda galaxy. People have been imaging all around the Andromeda galaxy and looking at looking down to very faint stars and looking at the structures of stars around Andromeda. And what they found is that Andromeda is built from a bunch of galaxies that are small galaxies that emerged together to form this beautiful spiral galaxy. And some of the traces of those small galaxies are still this trail. There's little trails of stars in the outskirts of the galaxy. This Hubble Space Telescope project that I'm involved in is moving that kind of information towards the center of the galaxy, where from a telescope on the ground, which where the stars twinkle too much and they blur out, and we're not able to make out individual stars within the near the center of the Andromeda galaxy. But with Hubble, we can identify more than 100 million individual stars from these images, and we can really extend the study of this kind of stellar archaeology, trying to understand how the galaxy was built up from these images.
So Hubble has really changed what astronomers are doing, because it provides these really detailed images that you just can't get from the ground. It's you know, in orbiting the Earth, so it's beyond the atmosphere and all of the junk that is in the air. And so it gives you these really clear images.
Yeah, I think, a lot of times when people come and look through a telescope for the first time, they're kind of disappointed because they've seen all these beautiful Hubble Space Telescope pictures of galaxies and when you look with your eye from the ground, it's spectacular in its own way. But there's a really it's the level of detail is much less that you can see from the ground, even if you take a really deep image, than it is if you get above the atmosphere and the blurring effects of that atmosphere.
And so the photos you're studying are from something called PHAT, P-H-A-T, Panchromatic Hubble Andromeda Treasury. I understand.
I'm glad you said that, so I don't have to.
I understand the FAT data is expected to show 100 million individual stars in Andromeda. I mean, that's incredible. Hard to even wrap your mind around that.
Yeah, and it's one of the amazing things about that is that it's really just a small fraction of all of the stars we think are in Andromeda. We think there's hundreds of billions of stars, so we're observing, maybe one out of every 1,000 stars or even less. What we're really observing are the brightest stars in Andromeda, the ones that are really that are easiest to see. But there's still a vast number of them that we can see. But for instance, we wouldn't be able to see our own sun. We need to look at stars that are brighter than that in order to see them in Andromeda.
And that's why you're enlisting regular folk, just people like you and me. Well, not you, but me, to go out and to help identify some of the features in Andromeda.
Yeah, I've actually enlisted myself too. So,
okay.
Me and 8 other scientists actually spent about a month each looking through images when we first started getting these images, and then they keep building up, and we looked through about 20% of them and found 600 of these groupings of stars, star clusters, which are really interesting, which I'll get to in a second. But we realized that once, if we're gonna multiply that by five, that we each didn't want to be spending 5 months just sitting in front of our computer looking at images, even though the images are really beautiful. So we had this idea that we could crowdsource this problem, and we could get other people to help us with it. And there's actually some precedents for this in astronomy. That there's some very successful projects, one called Galaxy Zoo, that have used this used regular people to find really amazing and interesting scientific results.
We're going to talk more about star clusters and about galaxies and just how the universe works with this new project, Andromeda Project. Dr. Anil Seth is with us. He is an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah. He's going to be talking about the Andromeda Project tonight during Science Night Live. It's a casual lecture, I suppose, Wednesday, December 5th at 5:30 at Keys on Main, 242 South Main Street here in Salt Lake City. And again, you can find out more about the Andromeda Project online at andromedaproject.org or go to kcpw.org for more information. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Thank you. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. How do galaxies form? And how do stars within those galaxies form? Those are among the questions that scientists are hoping to answer by examining detailed images of the Andromeda Galaxy, and they need your help. They're looking for thousands of volunteers to peer at photos from the Hubble telescope and help them gather information about Andromeda. It's called the Andromeda Project, and today on the program, we're learning more about this citizen science effort with Dr. Anil Seth. He's an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah. He's launching a new website in conjunction with other scientists around the globe, AndromedaProject.org. You can find links at our website, kcpw.org. Also, he'll be discussing the Andromeda Project during Science Night Live tonight, Wednesday, December 5th at 5:30 at Keys on Main. That's 242 South Main Street here in Salt Lake City. And if you'd like to join our conversation, if you marvel at images from the Hubble telescope or you wonder about the big questions of the universe that astronomers are trying to answer, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So part of the Andromeda Project, as we mentioned earlier in the segment, has to do with pinpointing star clusters. So, Dr. Seth, what exactly is a star cluster?
So star clusters are groups of hundreds or up to millions of stars, and they're very closely packed together. They're actually moving around each other. And those groups of stars were all born together, so they all shared a birth date. And that means that they're easier to find the age of than just an average star when sitting somewhere randomly in the galaxy, because we have this whole group of things that are all the same age. So we can really pinpoint the ages very well. And so that helps us with studying the history of the galaxy, because we can kind of identify these major epochs of star formation. But it also helps us with understanding how stars form, because we can, for instance, we're going to use the youngest of these star clusters to try understanding, you know, when we form 100 stars like the sun, how many stars do we form that are 10 times more massive than the sun? So the distribution of the number of stars of different masses. So those are the kinds of questions that we're going to be answering once we've collected this sample of clusters with your help, hopefully. So we could really use some volunteers, and I think it's a really beautiful and fun project to participate in.
So for the person out there who doesn't know anything about star clusters, how hard is it to identify a star cluster in an image? I mean, is it kind of, you know it when you see it?
Yeah, it's a little bit. I mean, the human eye is pretty amazing. You know, we learn to pick up patterns pretty quickly. And so there's a really short training tutorial on the website. It takes less than a minute. And after that, you can start identifying star clusters. And maybe, you know, when you first start, you might not be super great at it. But every click counts. And the more you do, the better you'll get at it. And so we really want, you know, just we want really broad participation really hoping to get, you know, all types of people, not just amateur astronomers, but, you know, people who are just kids that are, you know, in middle school, or people who are retired, you know, anyone who's rather than spending time on surfing the web, you know, they could spend some time working on the Andromeda Project.
Huh. I guess the question that a lot of people will have is, why don't you use technology to help you instead of trying to recruit a bunch of warm bodies who don't know anything about the night sky? You know, isn't there some kind of software out there that can help you sift through these images and pinpoint with some accuracy these star clusters that you're looking for?
Yeah, so we've been trying to do that. We have people on our team who've been working on software to do exactly that. But how it's turned out is that no matter what we do, because the clusters actually look quite different in different places, because they have different ages, they have different sizes, different masses. There's different numbers of stars, and in addition, they appear against very different backgrounds. The background is varying like crazy. And so, you know, they're right in the center of the galaxy. The star cluster will look a little different than it will out in the outskirts of the galaxy. And so it just turns out it's very, very difficult to write a program that identifies a large number of star clusters without getting a lot of false positives. So the false positives are, you know, meaning that we have lots of things that aren't star clusters, that when we look at them, they're clearly not star clusters, but the programs identified them. And so so we found that we just have to go through them by eye, even if we use the software. And so basically, it's the best tool that we have is our own eyes.
Somehow that's so empowering as a human to be able to do something that a computer cannot. how much do you really need to know about astronomy, though, to participate in the Andromeda Project? Are you looking for people who are experts?
No, not at all. I think you really don't need to know anything to start looking at these images. They're kind of pretty self-explanatory in some ways. But there's also a lot of information. If you start working on it and you think it's fun, you can learn more by looking at all of the, there's a bunch of kind of guides and text and pictures on the website that kind of explain what we're doing. And so we're hoping, I guess, you know, to find people and get them interested and excited, and not necessarily people who are already interested and excited.
Again, you can check out more information on the Andromeda Project at andromedaproject.org or just go to kcpw.org. We've got some links online. If you'd like to join us, we're speaking with Dr. Anil Seth. He's assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah. One of the driving forces behind the Andromeda Project. You mentioned you're one of six or eight astronomers involved in the Andromeda Project. I mean, how did you get roped into this? And why does Andromeda hold such a draw for you personally?
Yeah, so the project that this is, the overall project, the FAT project, which you mentioned earlier, is actually a very, very large project. It has over 40 people involved. But I'm actually leading the team that's trying to work on these star clusters. So that's kind of my role in this. I got involved from the very beginning at writing the proposal that we wrote to get the telescope time a few years ago. I'm forgetting your second question.
Oh, just wondered why you like Andromeda. I mean, why do you want to spend your time there?
Well, I mean, it really is a unique place to look at because it's the nearest big galaxy to our own. So it means that, you know, in the next nearest galaxy, which is about, you know, twice or three times as far away as Andromeda, that means that we're going to be able to see about 10 times fewer stars than we can in Andromeda with the same pictures. And so we can really do a lot more. We can study the history a lot more accurately in Andromeda than we could in a more distant galaxy. And as I mentioned earlier, looking in the Milky Way, lots of astronomers spend their time trying to uncover the history of the Milky Way. And there's definitely a lot of observations that are only possible within the Milky Way. But there are also a lot of complications because we can't see all of the stars and because we can't measure their distances easily.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about your personal research? This project is focusing on identifying star clusters. You like to think about something called a nuclear star duster.
Cluster.
I guess I misread that.
Star cluster.
What is that?
So at the centers of galaxies, we have really, really massive clusters of stars. So the typical star cluster that if you go to the AndromedaProject.org and you look at, the typical star cluster will maybe have 1,000 stars in it. At the very centers of galaxies, we see these massive clusters of stars that sometimes have 10 million stars in them. The density of these objects is incredibly high. So between us and the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is a few light years. And in that, if we lived at the center of one of these nuclear star clusters, there would be hundreds of thousands of stars closer than the closest star to us now. Mm. And so that's really an amazing, they're really amazing objects. And the other thing is that they provide us a way of studying how gas gets to the center of galaxies. And maybe some of your listeners know that at the center of our own galaxy, there's what we call a supermassive black hole. And this is a black hole that weighs 4 million times the mass of the sun.
Wow.
So it's like 4 million suns crammed into a tiny, tiny area. And this black hole we really don't understand how these supermassive black holes form. And we find them in almost every large galaxy that we look at. And these nuclear star clusters are a record, provide us a record, because they're stars that are shining, and we can tell from their light when they formed. These nuclear star clusters provide a record of how gas accreted into the centers of galaxies. And we can also use them. We can look at the motions of the stars in those clusters to try finding black holes. And one of my other projects is trying to find the very lowest mass galaxies that have these really big black holes sitting at the center of them. We think that very, very small galaxies don't, but at some point we start seeing these really big black holes sitting at the centers of galaxies.
And how do we know that there are black holes?
Well, so it's really hard. So there's a couple ways. One is that if they're eating, if they're sucking in gas, then the gas that's right before it gets eaten up gets really bright. And we call that an active galaxy nucleus. And we can see that it has distinct signatures. We can see X-ray, very high energy light coming from that from those objects. And another way that we can tell is just from the gravitational influence they have on the stars around them. So, for instance, in the center of our own galaxy, there's a star that orbits very, very close within, kind of solar system scales of the center of the galaxy, goes around every 20 years or so, and it's orbiting at significant fractions of the speed of light. And if there was no black hole there, there'd be no reason for it to be whipping around this point in space that we don't see anything else at without having the black hole there. So that's how we infer the presence of black holes, is we can see the effects of their gravity.
Hmm. I guess, is that something that you can capture on the Hubble images that you're looking at as well? And I don't know if that's a further step on the Andromeda project, looking for black holes.
No, not really. This project is kind of separate from that research a little bit. They're common in the sense that they're both star clusters, and we're interested in understanding the formation of both of them and age dating both of them. But the Andromeda project is primarily something to study the galaxy formation as a whole, rather than just the very centers of the galaxies.
Hmm. The Andromeda project will succeed if you can get a lot of volunteers to come on board and participate. Are you nervous when you cast the net out there? What if the volunteers screw up? What if they don't know what they're looking for or make mistakes? I mean, is there a safety net for you as researchers?
Yeah, I mean, we all make mistakes. I'm sure that I made some mistakes in my initial identifications of star clusters. But we definitely have ways of trying to calibrate for whether someone who really, really is doing a good job of identifying star clusters versus people who aren't. And we can use all that information. Anyone's information is really helpful for us. And the way that we do that is we have this set of star clusters that we've already identified that represents about a fifth of the data that's on the project website. So we can look at that as kind of a training set, so we can figure out, you know, when people see these images where we've identified star clusters, do they identify star clusters in the same places? And just from, we had some beta testers, like a few hundred people that tested out our site early on. And just from that, I can say that, the people really are just as good as we are. And there's things in a few images that I was looking through where the beta testers found something that I kind of, or we had passed over, and actually was probably a real star cluster. Huh. So I think there's really, it's really fun that way. You know, it's definitely something where it by sharing the load, we can really do a lot better than we could do individually.
So who's your target audience? Do you have one? I'm assuming that you are requiring your students at the University of Utah to participate. Are there other groups of people that you're trying to harness?
Yeah, I'm not actually requiring them to participate.
Oh, they can come
get
on,
extra
professor,
credit.
You should be doing
they
that.
They can get extra credit for doing it. Yeah, so I really don't think there's a specific target audience except for people who, you know, spend time on computers. Like if you,
what about kids?
Yeah, kids can definitely participate. We could, I imagine, you know, any kid older than 7 or 8 could probably do a pretty good job of doing this. So yeah, definitely we expect to have lots of children. There's some famous, I mentioned that there was a project an ongoing project that's called the Galaxy Zoo, and they've had hundreds of thousands of users, and they come from all different types of, you know, they're all different types of people. In our beta tester group, we had, you know, a retired archaeologist. We had someone from China. There's people from all over the place that participate in this. So there's some possibility that you could discover something new and become kind of famous in a very limited way. For instance, in the Galaxy Zoo project, there was a woman in the Netherlands who found this object that was the echo of a dying black hole, a dying quasar, which is an accreting black hole. And that object is now named after her. It's called Hanny's Voorwerp.
Love it.
You can really participate in science and really make some interesting discoveries.
Mm. We've only got a couple minutes left, but so what are you going to do with all this information? There are so many images to comb through and to pore over. Once this little project is done, then what?
Yeah, so that's when the real science begins. So, I mean, our first task is going to be to create a catalog out of all of the people's viewings and clickings on their images. That I'm going to be working with an undergraduate at the University of Utah to help, who's going to help me with that. But then once we have that catalog of star clusters, that's when we can really start looking at, you know, what are the ages of all these star clusters? How big are they? And that's when we can really start getting into the formation history aspect of the science, and also starting to study the process of star formation in the galaxy. So we can look, you know, at this. I mentioned earlier that we're trying to find the spectrum of stellar masses that form, so that we can start examining questions like that. We're going to actually pass this data off to many different groups of people within our project.
Hmm. And I guess I should mention that we should get to know Andromeda, since we're on a collision course with Andromeda, right?
That's right. Yeah, we're gonna collide in a few billion years. We're gonna be colliding with the Andromeda galaxy, and this isn't really a big concern for us because the density of stars is actually really low. So it's not like our sun is gonna run into another star, but we will see some new stars in the heavens Our own galaxy will probably be transformed from being a spiral galaxy once we collide with Andromeda. And after a few hundred million years, everything settles out. We'll actually be a more round galaxy, an elliptical galaxy. That's actually how we think elliptical galaxies form.
Okay, that's the future in a few billion years from Dr. Anil Seth. He's an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Utah. He's speaking tonight during Science Night Live, Wednesday, December 5th at 5:30 p.m. at Keys on Main, 242 South Main Street. Check it out. Also, check out our website, kcpw.org. We've got links to the Andromeda Project, or you can just find it at andromedaproject.org. Dr. Seth, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, ways to avoid foreclosure. Coming back to Earth, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Foreclosures in Utah are on the decline. That's the good news. But some local homeowners are still struggling to make that mortgage. And today on the program, we're hearing about some programs and some settlements that can help homeowners in trouble. Joining me in studio is Afton January. She is the program and event coordinator for the Utah Housing Coalition. It's a nonprofit that works to increase the amount of accessible, affordable housing statewide. And Afton, good morning. Thanks so much for the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
And the Utah Housing Coalition and the Utah Attorney General's Office, they're both hosting a community meeting about foreclosure solutions. That's happening tomorrow, Thursday, December 6th. We'll give you details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, if you're looking for a way to avoid foreclosure yourself, or you narrowly escaped, give us a call. Join us with your experience. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Afton, as I mentioned, foreclosure filings are down across the country. What's the picture here in Utah right now?
Well, here in Utah, we are very fortunate that we have finally dropped below the super high threshold of foreclosures that we've been seeing. In 2009 and 2010, Utah was ranked consistently fourth, fifth, and sixth in the nation each quarter. Mm. You know, up there, really high rate of foreclosures with states like California, Arizona, and Florida that, you know, got so much media attention on the national stage. Fortunately, that situation has abated somewhat. According to RealtyTrack, which is an online source of tracking information about housing markets across the country, Utah is currently ranked 16th in the country for foreclosures. So significantly lower than we have been before, but still higher than many of our neighbors in other states. So I'm here today to try to get the word out about some of the programs that can help homeowners who are finding themselves in the situation currently.
Why was Utah so high on the scale, do you think?
You know, it's really hard to say. The thing about foreclosure is that there's so many factors that go into it that it's hard to put your finger on just one cause of foreclosure. But we can make some pretty reasonable assumptions based on things that we've heard anecdotally from clients and data from places like RealtyTrack, CoreLogic, and other entities that track information in the housing market. We know that there was a large number of subprime loans going into the market in the early part of the 2000s. Of course, subprime refers to loans that are made to folks who may not otherwise be able to receive a traditional mortgage. So folks who have maybe a smaller down payment, poor credit history, not a very long credit history, or are otherwise not very informed about the homeownership process. And so what has happened in the subprime market is that a lot of people didn't understand the terms of the loans that they were taking out. Some people were taken advantage of by, you know, unscrupulous actors in the housing markets. And, you know, some folks just took out mortgages that were just too much for them. They got in over their heads. They didn't realize they weren't going to have the ability to pay things like option ARMs, which is an adjustable rate mortgage mm-hmm. where the mortgage can jump significantly. Those are the kinds of things that we saw in the early part of the century here in Utah's markets. And so that caused a pretty significant first wave of foreclosures, which in my opinion shot us up into that, you know, fourth, fifth, and sixth range for the first first little while of the foreclosure crisis. Mm. Obviously, since then, other things have happened that have continued snowballing the foreclosure situation. So with the economic crash, you had a lot of people losing jobs, a lot of people seeing reduced income due to reduced work hours, those types of things. And then there are normal events that happen in people's lives that cause foreclosures regardless of what's happening in the overall economy. So things like divorce, death, and costly medical bills are things that also push people into foreclosure. So those are some of the reasons that we believe the foreclosure situation, has been so severe here in our state.
Mm-hmm. The foreclosure filings are going down, which is good. That's not to say that there are still many local homeowners who are facing foreclosure. Can you tell us, is there a profile of a homeowner who's underwater? Is it affecting suburban areas or rural areas or geographic areas of the state? Can you put it in some context that way?
Sure. So we've seen a couple of different things happening. Down in St. George, where you have a lot of the larger, more luxury type homes, we saw a lot of foreclosures in 08, 09, and 2010. Currently, we're seeing a lot more people in their primary residences who are going into foreclosure, and those folks tend to be people who have some education. So a lot of folks who have bachelor's degrees, associate's degrees, most of the people who are going through foreclosure now have at least a high school education. It's hard to put your finger down on a particular demographic profile in terms of race or ethnicity, because foreclosure has really affected people in a broad range of those types of backgrounds. But the average person in foreclosure is someone who has had a full-time job, and for some reason their income is decreased. Many of them have children. We see a high number of folks who've served in the military and, you know, regular folks who do work in the community that you would never imagine. So teachers, firefighters, police officers, you know, those are the types of folks that we're seeing come in, just, you know, regular people like you and me who've gotten into a bad situation and need some help.
We're speaking with Afton January. She's the program and event coordinator for the Utah Housing Coalition, which aims to increase the amount of accessible, affordable housing statewide. They, along with the Utah Attorney General's Office, they're hosting a community meeting about foreclosure solutions tomorrow, Thursday, December 6th, from 10 a.m. to noon at the State Capitol in the East Building in the Copper Room. And if you need more information, 801-364-0077. And you can find out all that information on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions about how to avoid foreclosure, 801-355-TALK is our number. So the good news, Afton, is that there are some programs to help people. First, tell us about the Independent Foreclosure Review. What exactly is that?
Sure. So the Independent Foreclosure Review is a program that was rolled out by the Office of the Comptroller of Currency and the Federal Reserve Bank System a couple of years ago to look at situations where people were already foreclosed on, meaning that their home has been taken away, they've moved, situations where maybe those foreclosures didn't take place appropriately. So perhaps some laws were broken, perhaps the mortgage servicers didn't negotiate in good faith with the homeowners, things like that. So what the Independent Foreclosure Review does is it allows homeowners who are foreclosed between January 1st, 2009 and December 31st, 2010 to apply to have their whole situation, that whole foreclosure situation, looked at by an independent consultant who is not connected to the banks.
So if you have reason to believe that your foreclosure shouldn't have taken place.
Yes.
If the deadlines were accelerated or for whatever reason you didn't have full information, what are some other ways that you would qualify for this independent review?
So if you were in a situation where your foreclosure was, as we like to say, dual tracked, which is where a mortgage servicer would work with a homeowner and put them into a trial modification where their payments are reduced for you know, maybe 3 to 6 months. But at the same time, those servicers were proceeding with filing foreclosures. So, you know, I'm the homeowner and I'm making my reduced payments, and all of a sudden I get a notice on my door saying your home will be sold at auction 30 days from today. Those types of situations are the types where people might have an opportunity to have their foreclosure reviewed and possibly receive some kind of compensation because what happened to them wasn't right.
Mm. I understand there's another program, the National Mortgage Settlement, and Utah got this huge settlement.
Yes.
$171 million, massive amount of money to compensate those who suffered from an illegal foreclosure or some sort of delay in their loan. Tell us about how you qualify for the National Mortgage Settlement. Please.
Sure. The National Mortgage Settlement is actually very similar to the Independent Foreclosure Review, but there are additional things that go along with that settlement that aren't available with the Foreclosure Review. So the National Mortgage Settlement was reached by 49 states, attorneys generals, and the U.S. Department of Justice with the nation's five largest mortgage servicers. Most homeowners are going to find that their mortgage is serviced by one of these banks. So you've got Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citi, Chase, and Ally, which is also GMAC. Mm-hmm. Those are the participants in this settlement. What the settlement does is it allows homeowners some options in terms of looking at where a foreclosure may have been wrongful and trying to seek some kind of compensation for that, as well as people who are currently in default or who need to receive a modification. There's opportunities for that as well.
Yeah.
So we've got a deadline coming up on this National Mortgage Settlement of January 18th. And the deadline for that is the deadline for applying to make a claim for a wrongful foreclosure. So if your home was already taken away from you during the time period that is specified by the settlement, then you might have an opportunity to receive some compensation. So, of course, that timeline is January 1st, 2008 through December 31st, 2011. So that portion of the settlement is very similar to the independent foreclosure review, but it covers a larger time frame. The reviews under that will be performed, I believe, by the same company that's actually performing the reviews under the independent foreclosure review. So they know their stuff, and they're going to be looking at these things from an unbiased angle, trying to see if people were wronged, if their rights were violated, or if the banks didn't act in good faith with them.
As I was researching this topic, I came across a story in the SF Weekly. It's an alternative newspaper in San Francisco that said that only 7% of the eligible homeowners have filed a request for the independent foreclosure review. Just 7%.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's such a small number. And I guess the question is why? Why are so few people who may well qualify for federal help when it comes to these foreclosure filings? I mean, why are people in danger of foreclosure or who have been foreclosed on not reaching out, not going to get some help that they qualify for?
You know, Jennifer, my hunch is that a lot of folks who've been through this process are fatigued. Mm-hmm. They're tired. They're fed up. They've lost their trust in the system, you know, not just in the banking system, but perhaps in the other systems, government systems and nonprofit systems that exist to help them. The foreclosure process can be extremely disheartening, and I think that might even be an understatement. It's something that causes a lot of stress in people's marriages. There's a lot of shame around it. But in addition to that, when you're working through the process of trying to save your home with one of these mortgage servicers, most homeowners are going to find that the process is extremely complex and convoluted, that there aren't any quick answers, that the personnel that they're dealing with on the other end of the phone doesn't always know the answers and isn't always necessarily happy and willing to help. Mm. And that's why we have housing counselors here in our state. By calling 211, which is the free information and referral service, homeowners throughout the state in all different stages of homeownership can get in touch with a nonprofit housing counselor who won't charge any money for their services. And what these counselors do is everything from educating first-time homebuyers, young people who are thinking, you know, this is a good time to buy a home, which, you know, it is. Rates are low. There's lots of houses out there. But also people who are wanting to apply for these different types of programs but feel tired and fed up with the process, as well as folks who might not be eligible for these programs but still want to try to work through a foreclosure or a default situation with their own mortgage servicer. The counselors are well-educated. They're unbiased. They don't charge money for their services. And by calling 211, homeowners can get in touch with them. And those are folks who can act as an advocate for these homeowners, particularly those who are fed up with the process but still might be eligible to receive some compensation.
Sure. 211, we'll put that on our website, kcpw.org. As you mentioned, the deadlines for these two federal programs are fast approaching.
Yes.
I mean, is it complicated? If you already have the fatigue, do you need to go out and get a lawyer? Can you just get help through the housing counselors? Or what other avenues, what kind of expert advice can help you through the application process for both of these two specific programs, the independent foreclosure review and the national mortgage settlement?
Sure. My opinion is that the nonprofit housing counselors are going to be the best first resource for any homeowner who's facing foreclosure, whether that is just its own foreclosure situation or whether you want to apply for one of these programs.
And I assume you're going to have more help at this event that you have tomorrow.
Yes, we will have some housing counselors up there to answer questions for homeowners about everything in the foreclosure process, from, you know, what the timeline is in the state of Utah through how they should apply for these separate programs. You mentioned attorneys. Attorneys are great resources for homeowners, particularly if they feel that laws were broken or their rights were violated and they would like to make additional legal claims against these banks. Neither of these programs preclude homeowners from seeking additional damages in the civil system. So if you were wronged, if you know that your home was taken, or at least you feel very strongly that your home was taken away from you in an improper manner, certainly apply for these programs, but you may also want to seek legal advice as well. Certainly an option.
And if someone wants to go to these meetings tomorrow, do they have to bring anything other than their story?
Nope, just come ready, ready to receive some information, and we will help you through the process. We plan to have some computers there up and running so people can look through these websites that provide the information on how to apply, as well as the application forms themselves. As I mentioned previously, we will have some housing counselors there to answer questions about how to do this. You know, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of folks just are tired of the process. They feel overwhelmed. It can be very stressful, and so I would definitely encourage people to take advantage of these free nonprofit services while they still exist.
Afton January with the Utah Housing Coalition. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Utah Housing Coalition and the Utah Attorney General's Office hosting a community meeting about foreclosure solutions. That's happening tomorrow, Thursday, December 6th, from 10 a.m. to noon at the State Capitol East Building in the Copper Room. And you can find out more information by calling 801-364-0077. City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, Utah's Wasatch Range and just how the mountains inspire those in our community. We'll find out more tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.